Despite the growing Persian film and television industry, both popular and artistic foreign films and serials, especially Hollywood productions, continued to dominate the Iranian écran throughout the 1960s and 1970s. Entertainment value aside, in these films, Hollywood in many ways visualized for ordinary Iranians images of Western societies, lifestyles, and gender roles, and in the process reinforced potent stereotypes. It was essentially through film that Iranians perceived America as an exciting land of opportunity, though not free from violence. The images of cowboys in the Wild West, the mafia fighting in the streets of big cities, and plenty of racism, militarism, and promiscuity, all complemented in the eyes of the non-Western viewers the realities of the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement, and political assassinations. Biblical epics, predictably, were favorites of all classes, for they portrayed familiar stories of ancient prophets in a novel context. Starting with such high-budget productions as Quo Vadis, 1951, and The Robe, 1953, the stream of movies with biblical content culminated with Cecil B. DeMille's 1956 remake of The Ten Commandments, William Wilder's 1959 Ben-Hur, and finally the 1961 King of Kings, released in Iran as Farugh-e-Bi-Payan, or Unending Glory, presumably to avoid implying the Pahlavi royal title Shahanshah, or the King of Kings. For Iranian filmgoers, especially in larger cities, these moralistic narratives of the origins of Judaism and Christianity were complementary to the Islamic portrayal of Moses and Jesus, and yet different in many ways. Quranic narratives, Gisas aside, for centuries the prophets of the Hebrew Bible, especially Joseph and Moses, and the story of Jesus and Mary, had been revered in Persian literature. Hollywood also displayed images of America not only as promoter of biblical narrative or liberating force that saved the world from Nazi Germany and later stood against Soviet aggression, but also as a land of prosperity and industrial and technological advances. The high-budget epics, as well as adventure movies, slapsticks in early days and light comedies later, thrillers and gangster movies, each in their own way enamored viewers by their scale, glitter, technical marvel, and acting skills. Movie stars were household names, and beside American presidents, just about the only American personalities known to the general public. Glamour, physical appeal, and daring stunts captivated younger viewers. For some, mostly the urban, secular middle class, the films served as prototypes of fashion and outfit. For others, mostly males of puritanical religious persuasion, they were demonstrations of sinful outrage. As more movie theaters opened in smaller cities across Iran in the 1960s and 1970s, often screening second- and third-rate Iranian and foreign movies, the magic of cinema fascinated more Iranians not merely as a form of entertainment, but also as a point of reference to measure the realities of their own society and culture and those of the others. A world of imagination that could be admired or despised, sought after or avoided, and many times mixed feelings of desire and rejection were intertwined. It is not without reason that from the mid-1970s, movie theaters became chief targets of militant Islamic attacks, who burned them down, especially in smaller and more religious cities, as symbols of an alien malady. Takhti, People's Champion. The cinema and its popular heroes and anti-heroes had a strong competitor in the world of sports, an alternative arena in which the Iranian working classes could engage and occasionally excel. Of all the Iranian sports, traditional wrestling, kushti, made the most successful transition to modern sports to become what is today freestyle wrestling. Part of the workout in Zarkhaneh, wrestling was the physical test for a pahlavan, champion, placing him within the ritualistic setting of the Zarkhaneh above any other role model. The Zarkhaneh, probably the most accessible venue for the underprivileged, with an exclusively male membership, were magnificent sports houses rooted in the Persian culture of rivalry, Javan Mardi, often affiliated in distant past with popular Sufi orders. In reality, they were often venues for neighborhood lutis and their rookies. Before their decline in the Pahlavi era, they could be found in most neighborhoods, a domed structure with modest appearance, a sunken arena in the middle, a Murshed trainer in his elevated bench conducting the collective workouts with the exhilarating rhythm of an enormous Persian drum, reminiscent of kettle drums, and melodic recitations from the Shahnameh and from Shi'i Sufi poetry repertoire. As the Pahlavi state began to encourage and sponsor modern sports through schools, factories, and modern gyms, much of the Zurkhaneh's talent and energy was diverted to new sports stages. Freestyle wrestling, along with weightlifting and soon soccer, became popular sports. Iranian teams made their appearance as early as the 1948 London Olympic Games, and by the 1952 Olympic Games in Helsinki, they were earning medals. For the Iranian public, success in the Olympics was a source of excitement and pride, coming at the time of Iran's oil nationalization campaign. The most luminous of all Iranian sportsmen in modern times, on both the national and the international stage, no doubt is Ghulam Reza Takhti, 1930-1968, a hero of undiminished popularity, whose tragic end elevated him in the public esteem to the pantheon of modern Iranian icons. A great wrestler with a magnificent physique, who won medals in three Olympics, silver in 1952 in Helsinki, gold in 1956 in Melbourne, and another silver in 1960 in Rome, he managed to stay in form for as long as 12 years, during the golden years of Iranian wrestling, when the national team twice was world champion. He was loved, however, beyond his sporting successes for his amiable personality, his shy and unassuming demeanor, and in later years, his independent political views. A stalwart supporter of Mossadegh and a member of the Second National Front, he personified in truth a modern Luti in his most upright manifestation, someone who, in the public eye, revived the chivalrous tradition of the Zurkhaneh and upheld its values. It was not without reason that in winning the traditional wrestling championship, he earned the title of world champion, Jahan Pahlavan, bestowed on him by the Shah, who personally fastened on Takhti's arm the traditional armlet. When he committed suicide in 1968 in a hotel room in Tehran, probably in a bout of severe depression, it was rumored that his death was foul play perpetrated by the Savak, just one of several untimely deaths of opposition figures, including Jalal Alleh Ahmad in 1969 and Ali Shariati in 1977, attributed to the security services, but without any credible evidence whatsoever. The symbolism of Takhti's death was evident. He appeared to his admirers as a victim of the Shah's regime. He was a tragic hero reminiscent of the virtuous Dash Akol, the chief character of Sadegh Hedayat's 1932 short story, who died fighting a wicked contender to save his honor. After 1979, Takhti was among the few popular heroes who survived the revolution. His name was conferred on many sports stadiums across the country, so that it has become almost generic. With the growing popularity of soccer through the 1960s and 1970s, and its regular media broadcast, wrestling and weightlifting took second place in favor of a team sport. Like societies of Latin America, Eastern Europe, and Africa, Iranian football soon emerged as an alternative public space reflecting collective aspirations, often in the absence of meaningful political venues. The gathering of large crowds in stadiums and the excitement of the match, particularly if played against foreign teams, carried a nationalistic weight. For the vast majority of Iranian fans attending the matches or watching them on the nationwide television broadcast, this was a shared experience of national solidarity. In the case of the 1968 matchup of Iran and Israel during the Asian Cup in Tehran, even though the Iranian team was victorious, afterward the Tehran crowd took to the streets in a mix of jubilation and an instantaneous anti-Israeli and, by implication, anti-regime protest. Fearing future such occurrences, the government introduced stringent security measures. A restive crowd displaying an ideological motive was an early indication of the popular defiance that would erupt a decade later in a popular revolution. Plague of the West and Search for Authenticity. Signs of dissent in music, cinema, and sports complemented a conceptual rethinking of Iranian culture and eventually a reassessment of religious myths and values. At the heart of this revisionist trend beyond the familiar mood of frustration and despair in poetry and music that had been characteristic of Iran's intellectual production ever since the 1950s, not to mention the post-constitutional era, was reassessment of such tokens as modernization and westernization. To this end, Jalal Alleh Ahmad's 1962 Garb Zadegi was hugely influential in setting a nativist discourse of a return to the authentic culture, and, by extension, to the authentic self. In the pungent days of the 1970s, Alleh Ahmad's discourse of cultural authenticity evolved into a journey of rediscovery for true Islam. A powerful motif before and during the 1979 revolution, Gharb Zadegi later rendered a rhetorical tool in the service of the Islamic Republic and its polemicists. By all appearances, Alleh Ahmad, 1923-1969, was an implausible candidate for the Islamic Hall of Virtual Martyrs to which he was elevated after his premature death. He was a beret-wearing, cigarette-smoking, heavy-drinking, intellectuel de gauche, loyal to the demeanour of that type. Handsome and witty, with a critical outlook and a sharp tongue, he held court in fashionable cafes in Tehran, where he discussed the latest highbrow French novels and remarked on works of his protégés with an air of subtle sarcasm worthy of an engagé intellectual. After visiting the United States in 1965, he was a fellow in the Harvard program for foreign intellectuals run by Henry Kissinger. He also became a jeans-wearing jazz buff. He had married an American-educated professor of art history, Simin Daneshvar, who became a celebrated novelist in her own right, and arguably superior to Alleh Ahmad. He was a translator of Gide, Camus, and Sartre. He read Steinbeck and Faulkner, in French or Persian translation, and he was influenced most visibly in his unique prose style by the French writer Ferdinand Céline. He was a literary critic, reviewing novels and plays as well as painting exhibitions, an ethnographer of sorts, with a true nostalgia for the old world of the Iranian countryside and its dying culture, and a travel writer who visited the Soviet Union, the United States and Israel, among other places, and wrote with his typical mix of biased sarcasm and skewed self-righteousness. Yet there was more to Alleh Ahmad's story. He was the son of a village mullah from the Talegan region. His father immigrated to Tehran in the 1920s. In his teens, young Jalal was a part-time apprentice in the Tehran bazaar while preparing to enter a seminary and become a mullah. His father's hopes were dashed when Jalal abandoned the life of the Shi'i clergy for a modern education and eventually became a high school teacher of Persian literature. Like most of the young and educated in the post-war era, he joined the Tudeh party in its early days, but soon became disillusioned with its Soviet-style communism after witnessing the duplicity of the Tudeh leadership and their subservience to Soviet ambitions during the Azerbaijan crisis and the botched Caspian oil concession. Reading André Gide's 1937 Return from the USSR, which he translated from French to Persian, only confirmed his aversion to Stalinism, although it did not erode his faith in socialism. He split from Tudeh in 1948, along with his mentor Khalil Maliki, and in 1952 he co-founded Niruye Sevom, Third Force, the Iranian version of the French Troisième Force, as an affiliate of the National Front. In 1960, the Third Force, under the new title Society of the Socialists of the National Movement, attracted a host of independent socialists, intellectuals, and younger activists. Despite internal tensions, even between Maliki and Alleh Ahmad, the society survived for another decade, having been barely tolerated by the regime. The nagging ghost of the Islamic clerical past never fully deserted Alleh Ahmad. As if he never came out from under his father's clerical robe, he discovered in the Shi'i clerical space an authentic quality. In this, he found a bastion against the onslaught of what seemed to him an alien, hegemonic West that metamorphosed non-Western societies into Westernized fakes that are gratefully subservient to their almighty hegemon. This was an outlook not in variance with the discourse of alienation in neo-Marxism of the 1950s and 1960s, and its permutation among the French existentialist thinkers, and in line with the fashionable debate of machinisme, all, of course, with an Islamicized cultural twist. Alleh Ahmad's serious pitfall, however, was to take this accidental cafe talk on Gharb Zadegi a step further into a grand cultural theory that he hurriedly and carelessly pieced together. Its aim was to place blame for the cultural, political, and social ailments of non-Western societies, such as Iran, squarely on the shoulders of Western modernity, and more so on the faulty experiences of Westernism in the 20th century. In this respect, Gharb Zadegi turned out to be, independent of the author's intention, perhaps, an ill-defined and self-righteous nativist theory. Such a discourse fit well into the grand narrative of Shi'i persecution, for it laid all the blame on the shoulder of the villainous other. Oblivious of the blind conservatism of the clerical elite, Alleh Ahmad shepherded the hapless intellectuals of the post-1953 generation to go back to their origins by seeking salvation in Shi'i culture of resistance, not in Marxism. Alleh Ahmad's Gharb Zadegi was, needless to say, an obvious reaction to the mindless positivism of the Europeanized Mustafrang type that dominated the stage in the post-constitutional era, and even more assertively during the Pahlavi epoch, a generation with a built-in inferiority complex over all things Western. These worshippers in the temple of Western civilization built the post-World War I Middle East from Turkey to the Arab world and South Asia. For them, even Europe's mad militarism, genocide, slavery, colonialism, and litany of other evils that darkened Europe's and America's histories were not all visible, or at best, were rationalized by the all-too-familiar rationale of might is right. First inspired through reading other Iranian critiques of Westernism, such as Khasravi, a greater conceptual influence upon Alleh Ahmad came from Ahmad Fardid, 1909-1994, who had coined the term Gharb Zadegi. Fardid was a professor of continental philosophy in Tehran University, and for a while had become the focus of Alleh Ahmad's attention and the core of his cultural orientation. As was Alleh Ahmad, Fardid was a reinvented intellectual who came from a madrasa background, a Heideggerian of sorts, or so he believed, with sporadic knowledge of Islamic philosophy and mysticism. Fardid had spent some years in post-war Germany, France, and Switzerland, where he immersed himself, unsystematically, in German idealist philosophy, and was deeply influenced by the anti-Semitic and anti-modernist traits still strong in post-Nazi European milieu. Returning to Iran in 1955, he was exposed to a discourse of Iranian Shi'i philosophy advanced by Henri Corbin, 1903-1978, the French scholar and head of the Institut Français in Tehran. Also a former Heideggerian, Corbin's keen interest in the philosophy of light, Maktab-e-Eshraq, and the so-called Theosophist school of Isfahan influenced a number of Iranian students of philosophy and intellectuals of his time. Corbin also belonged to a European circle of anti-modernist intellectuals who, concurrent with Heidegger's teachings, thrived in the early part of the 20th century in France and Germany. Contentious and eccentric, Fardid had a paranoid view of Iranian modernity, which was inherited by Alleh Ahmad. Fardid's ahistorical vision of the Islamic intellectual past made him argue that the course of Islamic philosophy had long been influenced, indeed adulterated, by the Greek post-Socratic and especially Aristotelian philosophy. He first labelled this the Greek malady, Yunan Zadegi, and then Gharb Zadegi. Having Heidegger's notion of reorientation in mind, as well as the German philosopher's preoccupation with pre-Socratic sages, Fardid prescribed a return to a new understanding of Persian mysticism and mystical poetry and to Islamic philosophy as a way of transcending the prevailing reality of the West. Alleh Ahmad tendentiously borrowed Fardid's Gharb Zadegi and popularized it by injecting a heavy dose of third worldism. He also adopted Fardid's anti-modernist stance, especially his critique of Iranian modernity of the 20th century, from the Constitutional Revolution to the Pahlavi era, in nearly all its aspects. This was a revolt against the kind of modernity of which Fardid and Alleh Ahmad both were undeniable byproducts. Westernism, in Naleh Ahmad's scheme, had become a pervasive affliction, like cholera or the plague, affecting all aspects of society and culture in Iran, as in all non-Western societies. Such a malaise, he argued, affected all aspects of education, culture, lifestyle, economic development, and social relations. These are symptoms that are devoid of any traditions to rely upon, any historical continuity, and any means of measuring change. They are only the gift of the machine. The phenomenon of the Garb Zadegi, Ali Ahmad believed, is characteristic of an era in our history when we have not yet mastered the machine and are unaware of its structure and know-how. In other words, an era when we are not yet fully acquainted with modern science and technology. Pahlavi modernism, he thus implied, was subservient to Western economic and geopolitical interests, and the chief reason for Iran's dependence and for Iranian alienation. Ali Ahmad's critique acquired him a growing readership, even though the censors had banned the book's official release. The weakest aspect of Garb Zadegi was its often erroneous and highly tendentious reading of the Iranian past. His careless and ideologically coloured assertions and his overall contemptuous view of Iran's political legacy came to influence generations of eager but naive readers. In this respect, Garb Zadegi may be counted among the most damaging Persian texts produced in the 20th century. Clandestinely available to all who wished to read it, in the climate of the 1960s and 1970s, when all other avenues of open and dispassionate political debate, even social criticism, were effectively closed, Ali Ahmad's pamphleteering offered a fresh alternative. Garb Zadegi's conspiratorial view of history blamed the West for everything that went wrong with the East, another questionable cultural construct. The pre-modern East was nostalgically painted as a pristine and authentic past that was, in his view, coherent and congenial, almost idyllic. In Ali Ahmad's conspiratorial worldview, aside from the sacred history of Islam and the Shi'i clerical establishment, few historical forces and actors remained unscathed. Culprits included movements of dissent from the Ismailis of Alamut to the Sufis, the Nogtavis, new schools of thought including Safavid philosophers of the 17th century, and religious minorities including the Jews and the Baha'is. Political powers from the Abbasid Caliphate to Turkish dynasties of the Islamic Middle Ages, the Mamluks of Egypt, the Ottomans, the Safavids and Qajars, and even the nomads of the Iranian interior were seen as creatures or collaborators or as unintended victims of sinister Christian powers that, ever since the inception of Islam, had been hatching plots against Muslims and especially against the people and culture of Iran. Their ranks included the Byzantines, the Crusaders, the Vatican, the Venetians and the Genoans, European trading companies, Christian missionaries, European travellers, and the more predictable nemesis, such as colonial empires of the 19th century, oil companies, US spy agencies, and the economic and cultural long arms of Yankee imperialism. In this cosmic onslaught of evil against the good, even the Mongols of the Gobi Desert and the Uyghurs of eastern Turkestan were not spared. European Christians not only had provoked the Crusades and the Mongol and Timurid invasions, but also somehow instigated the Sunni-Shi'i conflict between the Ottomans and Safavids. Later in the 20th century, the failure of pan-Islamism was considered the outcome of European plots. These were conspiracies to destroy the solidarity of the Muslims, taint their pure culture, and lay hands on their material resources. In Ali Ahmad's customary self-righteous tone and abbreviated style, this litany of assertions was appealing to his young and historically uninformed readership and soothing to their injured sentiments. His rendering of the Islamic past triggered a sense of victimization inherent in the Shi'i narrative and conveniently placed the fault of Muslim decline squarely on the shoulders of hostile others. Ali Ahmad's paranoid history aside, in many respects his Garb Zadegi, though rushed and polemical, anticipated not only critiques of Orientalism in the 1970s, but also the world system and dependency theories of the 1980s. Here, emphasis on the wholesale import of the West's material culture and ideas, adopting the so-called montage mentality, and relying on a rentier oil economy, was novel. It contested the Pahlavi modernism project and posed a counter-argument to the modernization theory in its heyday, when underdeveloped countries were demanded by the likes of the World Bank to resort to heavy industry, a planned economy, and wholesale overhaul of their agrarian economies. By contrast, Aleh Ahmad questioned the kind of rushed progress that summed up the Shah's White Revolution that emerged shortly after, and the mentality of the technocrats who presided over it. Before his eyes, Aleh Ahmad could see the dismantling of the village economies and village communities, growth of overpopulated and badly organized cities, and a way of life and an identity about to be wiped out. Yet, despite the advocacy of cultural authenticity, Aleh Ahmad also believed that inventing the machine would remedy the maladies of the developing societies. Though informed by the then fashionable discourse of machinisme, it is curious that he also subscribed to the modernization theory as a means of liberation from Western economic and cultural hegemony. Deeper still in Aleh Ahmad's Garb Zadegi was a fear of an alien intrusion revoking a Shi'i Iranian dichotomy of the chaste body versus the alien polluting agents. It was as if the satanic forces had invaded the pure core of believers. That is what brought Aleh Ahmad and a generation of like-minded intellectuals to the bosom of an idealized Islamic alternative, a popular slogan of revolutionary days, neither Western nor Eastern, but the Islamic Republic, Na Shargi Na Garbi, Jamhuriyya Islami, aptly resonated, Aleh Ahmad's lasting mark on shaping the Islamic Revolution. It is highly doubtful, however, that Aleh Ahmad himself would have survived that revolution, even in its initial stages. Shariati's Revolutionary Islam. Of comparable standing to Aleh Ahmad in the shaping of a nativist Islamic discourse was Ali Shariati, 1933-1977, another generational icon with an eclectic worldview. In the late 1960s, his fiery sermons, numerous popular books, pamphlets, and cassette recordings made him a new prophet of revolutionary Shi'ism. Like Aleh Ahmad, who had an early influence on him, Shariati, too, was born to a religious family from a village around Sabzevar, an old stronghold of Shi'ism, to Mashhad, where his father, a lay preacher of some fame, ran a religious center with a revivalist agenda. As with Aleh Ahmad, the national movement of the early 1950s and the dissident political culture that followed it into the 1960s also shaped Shariati. He too was a high school teacher and supporter of the National Front. His path diverted, however, once he moved to France on a government fellowship, where he earned a doctorat de l'université from the Sorbonne in sociology of religion. The not-so-rigorous degree, then acquirable with a modicum of academic effort, was good enough to land him on the faculty of Mashhad University. His dissertation, a run-of-the-mill textual analysis of a Persian mystical text, was of no scholarly value. While in France, Shariati became interested in politics of the left, and especially in the Algerian Revolution, then in the late 1950s, in full swing. He supported the Islamic wing of the movement and sympathized with its anti-colonial objectives, searching all the while for new readings of Islam through the prism of sociology of religion, then an academic novelty. Georges Gourvitch, 1894-1965, the Russian-born French sociologist and a strong advocate of Algerian independence, impressed Shariati and helped him contextualize Islam not merely as a system of beliefs and rituals, but as a socio-religious movement. He may have also been inspired by Louis Massignon's 1922 La Passion de l'Alaj, a seminal study of the life and time of the early Shi'i Sufi martyr. The young Shariati could not have missed Massignon's personal history, 1883-1962, and his inspirational neo-Catholicism, with its ecumenical tilt toward Islam and with a growing fascination with the Shi'i myth of martyrdom. The greatest influence on Shariati, however, came from the Caribbean-born France Fanon, 1925-1961, and his revolutionary anti-colonial thesis then in vogue among intellectuals of the left. Fanon, a Francophone intellectual, became almost a role model for Shariati, who translated into Persian his The Wretched of the Earth, Les Damnés de la Terre, soon after it was published in 1961. Through Fanon, Shariati came to view the struggle against colonialism, then epitomized by the Algerian Revolution, as an existential struggle for human liberation, in which suffering and sacrifice of the oppressed were to restore not only political freedom, but also human dignity and moral responsibility. Fanon had become the voice of passionate intellectuals and activists of the so-called Third World, a term widely employed to define a geography of deprivation and dependency on the West. Still socialist in its core, Fanon's anti-colonialism went beyond Marxian class struggle to emphasize national, cultural, ethnic, and religious ties. These he held as crucial tools for struggle, even armed struggle, to cast off alien ideologies on both sides of the global divide. Shariati absorbed that message, but refashioned it to fit his own mytho-historical reading of Shi'ism. Returning to Iran in 1964, he was inevitably harassed by Savak and detained for his dissident activities abroad, but soon, possibly after giving assurances, he was allowed to hold his university position, teaching sociology of religion and history in Mashhad University. He made a name for himself as a motivated teacher with radical views about Islamic history and setting it in a novel context for his growing audiences. His intellectual brinkmanship made him tolerable to the regime so long as he observed his rhetorical limits. Moving to Tehran a couple of years later, he soon became the most prominent public voice in Hosseiniyeh Ershad, where he came to be known as an inspirational speaker who understood the younger generations of alienated Iranians. Hosseiniyeh Ershad was a modern religious institution in northern Tehran, established in 1964 to promote a fresh Islamic perspective palatable to mostly university students and educated professionals. Reminiscent of Catholic establishments in France, or evangelical halls in the United States, or closer to home, to Tehran's former Baha'i Center, it was entirely different from the familiar environment of mosques and traditional takiyehs, where Muharram morning ceremonies were held. It was a domed structure with Persian tilework that covered a spacious hall equipped with auditorium seats, air conditioning, an audio system, a library, and exhibition space. Quranic verses in colourful tilework decorated the hall's centre stage. For Shariati, this offered the right ambiance to preach, for nearly a decade, his message of Islamic rediscovery and Shi'i activism in a language of restrained metaphors. For audiences who came in droves to listen to him, Ershad's surroundings presented something modern, bright, and dignified, an ideal setting for a charming lecturer, handsome, well-dressed in suit and tie, shaved, smiling, and speaking with a trace of a delightful Khorasani accent. He was a novelty even secularized middle-class Iranians could not ignore. Shariati's style was sentimental, even melodramatic, and intense. He loved preaching, understood his audiences, and knew which sympathetic chords to strike. Though long-winded to the point of being loquacious, repetitive, and declamatory, he was not boring, at least not to his young and dedicated followers who regularly attended his lectures, listened to his cassette tapes, and studiously devoured his growing oeuvre in print. His writing style was equally rambling, emotional, and intense, fitting the quasi-mystical and entirely ahistorical message that he was preaching. Sensational mytho-history was at the core of his popularity. Considering himself a theistic existentialist, Shariati sought a message of liberation in the Quranic narrative and in the Shi'i past. He was not interested in the empirical, factual history of Islam, which he dismissed as irrelevant and misleading, produced by oppressive powers and Westerners. Rather, he sought in the early Shi'i sacred past archetypes for his vision of revolt against political and religious oppressions. In his message, there existed a potent amalgam of Fanon, Sartre, and Massignon, alongside Marx, Mossadegh, Algeria's National Liberation Front, and Ole Ahmad, not to mention Shariati's own father and his advocacy of true Islam. Such characters were synthesized and amalgamated in Shariati's mind to make his early Islamic heroes speak his revolutionary message. They ranged from Ali, Hussein, and Fatima to such early companions of the Prophet as the emaciated Abyssinian slave Bilal and the pro-Alid figures Abu Zar al-Ghifari and Ammar ibn Yasir. In the vocal and written universe of Ali Shariati, they turned into champions of social justice, self-sacrifice, isar, and revolt against the oppressors. The early deniers of the Prophet among the Quraysh and the Umayyad descendants, Muawiyah and his son Yazid, were predictable villains. They were timely signifiers who pointed to the Pahlavi regime. In this sacred past, the age of the early believers, Shariati imagined a dynamic course when the pure, egalitarian, and self-sacrificing imams and their companions actively resisted their corrupt oppressors. This he called the age of Alid Red Shi'ism. Hence, in the House of the Prophet, the so-called Five of the Mantle of the Prophet, more popularly known as the Five Bodies, Panj Tan, namely Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Hassan, and Hussein, and their loyal supporters, he sought a religion of protest. In this narrative of revolutionary Shi'ism, Shariati was a modern promoter, Maddah, and a contemporizing reciter of the sufferings, who assigned to his wronged heroes the urgent task of revolutionary rebellion against their oppressive villains. By contrast, his Safavid black Shi'ism stood for clerical conservatism, which he characterized as compromising, pedantic, and rapacious. The dichotomy of the two forms of Alid and Safavid Shi'ism was devoid of plausible historical reference. Furthermore, he believed that the rise of Safavid Shi'ism against the Sunni Ottomans was the outcome of a conspiracy to divide Islamic unity, a conspiratorial perspective he shared with Alla Ahmad. Yet his mytho-history was electrifying to his audiences, who could contrast Shariati and his seemingly valiant and dynamic Islam to the stagnant world of turbaned Shi'ism. Shariati's criticism of the Pahlavi regime was understandably implicit, though not entirely veiled. Nor were his allusions beyond the grasp of the Savak agents, who routinely monitored his activities and occasionally harassed him. Despite much disruption by Savak and a break with Murtaza Motahari, 1919-1979, a representative of the less rigid clerical wing of Ghom, who also was active in Ershad, Shariati went on lecturing and publishing until the closure of Ershad in 1972. His publications, widely available to people from all walks of life, was a source of anxiety to the regime. Yet the fact that he was not completely silenced, one may surmise, was because the regime valued him as an effective counterweight to a fast radicalizing clerical opposition in Ghom. Only in 1972, at the height of urban guerrilla clashes, Shariati was seen as a serious threat. He was accused of collaboration with the People's Mujahideen and subsequently spent 18 months in solitary confinement before being released with the Shah's consent, when international publicity for his release were loud enough to make the Shah realize the disadvantage of keeping a popular figure like Shariati in detention. For 2 years after his release, he lived under virtual house arrest with his health in serious decline. In early 1977, he was allowed to leave the country after Savak forced him to publish, or forged on his behalf, a statement in praise of the White Revolution. When he arrived in England in March, he was suffering from depression and other ailments. Soon after, he died of a massive heart attack in a hospital in Southampton. Oddly enough, the circumstances surrounding his death did not alarm the British authorities enough to hold an inquest. Regardless, Shariati was to be remembered by the Iranian opposition as another victim of the Savak, even though his premature death, like that of Alla Ahmad, was due to health reasons, most likely heavy smoking. Disarray in a cultural space. Nearly two decades of state patronage had opened a wider and more exciting cultural space in Iran. Media, especially television, artistic venues, the press and book publication, and growing viewership and readership offered intellectuals and artists a broader market and greater recognition. These happened despite the shrinking political horizons and the state's obsessive efforts to silence all forms of dissent or co-opt willing partners. Voices of dissent survived, however veiled, in the state's broadcasting network, in cinema, and in various cultural and public institutions. Insofar as giving Iranians a more articulate sense of themselves, the state was able to reap the fruits of a half-century of Pahlavi nationalist policies. But as it remained closely identified with a vision of positivist progress and westernizing modernity, it also set in motion a quest for authenticity and cultural sovereignty. Palpable in many quarters, among writers, poets, and filmmakers, the return to the authentic self had an irresistible lure. Popular music, even artists whose prosperity was indebted to middle-class stability under the Pahlavi rule, could occasionally sing ballads of heroic fall, alienation, and martyrdom. Intellectuals and activists who remained outside the state's reach had their own possibilities. Such figures as Alleh Ahmad, Shamlu, and later Shariati were able to frequent their own circles and speak, write, translate, and publish, so long as they avoided taboos. Overt criticism was out of the question, but political symbolism of all sorts and allusions to political repression and social ills were not entirely silenced despite censorship and intimidation. Metaphors, hints, and literary brinkmanship had long been familiar in the Persian milieu, and unsurprisingly they became second nature to the post-1953 generation. Under censorship, strategies of dissent thrived, ensuring greater originality and innovation. The audiences, too, shared in the codified language of dissent and took pleasure in unravelling literary cryptograms and political clues. A prevailing culture of resentment that was mastered by intellectuals and artists was well suited to a language of allusions and symbols and to the recycling of old paradigms of Shi'i Islam in a new activist guise. High but sanitized culture came to serve a purpose, releasing excessive social pressures created by a booming economy and autocratic rule. While the secularized middle classes could, and partially did, become absorbed into the cultural milieu, the lower middle classes, the urban migrants, and the traditional sectors of Iranian society, by and large, remained outside the state's reach. The state's cultural policies were largely geared to absorb the intellectual left rather than the forces of religious dissent. The former could relay cryptic messages of dissent as much as possible and hope for better days. The latter enjoyed fewer forums and had to rely mostly on its own traditional venues. The closure of Hosseiniyeh Ershad ironically diverted more energies and attention to mosques, Quran study classes, and inspirational preaching presided over by activist clergy who were not patronized by the state. Part 4. A Contested Revolution and the Rise of the Islamic Republic. The tumultuous events that led to the revolution of 1979 and the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran were a classic example of modern popular revolution, a momentary confluence of forces of discontent which mostly relied on mobilizing urban lower middle classes and the grassroots bazaar, succeeded in bringing down the Pahlavi regime and dismantling its power structure. Out of a broad alliance of Islamic tendencies, there emerged a militant clerical leadership, led by Ayatollah Khomeini. Over the course of the following decade, Khomeini played a decisive part in defining the Islamic Republic, as well as its ideology and institutions. Even though the revolution had its roots in Iran's experience of the past 7 decades, the rise and the consolidation of the new regime caused huge contentions and conflicts. Prevailing over its opponents at home, largely by coercion and violence, and despite setbacks in the prolonged war against its Iraqi neighbor, by 1989, when Ayatollah Khomeini died, the Islamic regime had been able, it was evident, to put down roots. Yet the years that followed revealed ideological chasms and political tensions within the Islamic Republic that echoed the demands of younger generations of Iranians for social freedoms, democracy, and an end to international isolation. independent of the Islamic regime's nepotism, ideological blind spots, and socio-economic quagmires, Iranian society did fundamentally evolve. It created its own space and its own culture and artistic imagination. 2 decades after the Islamic Revolution prevailed, the 2009 Green Movement revealed profound discontent and disillusionment within Iranian society.